Good evening. You are listening to The Talking Show on K Chung Radio, Chinatown's only micro broadcasting radio station for the arts. I'm Nicholas Miller. Here as always with Stephen Cato. Say hi, Stephen Cato.
Oh, hi. It's me. Hello. It's Steve Cato.
How are you doing, Steve?
Oh, you know, I'm just great. Every year when it's Art Fair Week, I just get so charged up with feelings of goodwill about my chosen profession.
Really?
I'm just I'm surfing high on this wave of good feelings about the visual arts after spending all of last week in an alcohol-induced coma.
Am I sensing a hint of sarcasm in your
delivery? Oh, boy. Wow, was the fair shitty. Wow. I didn't make it to Felix, but which at least has, you know, I didn't go, but at least the Roosevelt Hotel is like a charming location, I'll say.
That's
true. You know, the glamour of old Hollywood. it's an attractive place. Whereas a large white tent at the Santa Monica Airport is not an attractive place. It's the same as every other iteration of the Freeze Fair, right? Like it used to be on like Roosevelt or Governor's, not Roosevelt, but like, one of those other, peripheral islands.
Fire Island?
In New York City. No, not Fire. That's farther out.
Okay.
It's a little gayer.
unlike the Art Fair.
I mean, there's things about the Art Fair that are unfortunately not gay enough. No.
Yeah. Fair.
Could use, you know, there's that's not what we're talking about here, you know.
Yeah.
It's the least bacchanalian format for both gay and straight people in the creative fields, I think. It looked like a swap meet. It looked super shitty. You know, we got one of these, we got one of those, we got one in red, we got one in green. Like, what do you want? You know? Are you shocked that like Pace Gallery, you know, has these things on display? Like, no, because they represent these people, you know, like it's not like, you know, there's no like, ooh, you know, and also like, whatever, what is even the point of this? Because it's like everything's kind of already sold by the time anyone's even let into the building, you know?
Is that true? Like, I know that's the rumor, but do you have the stats?
Largely the case, right? Because it's like people send, you know, well, I should check my email. One of the things that's happened post-COVID is that I have gotten so bad at email that it's not even worth it for people to send them to me anymore. So I just receive like nonstop emails about everything. And I look at my email every other day in the faint hope that like something in there is of value. But almost at most, maybe I learn about like a BOGO sale on, you know, glasses from the online optometrist I frequent, or like, you know, cycling bibs on sale or something, you know, which like, hey, that's fine. But I'm, you know, like I'm trying not to spend as much money these days. I don't learn anything from my emails. No one's sending me anything exciting via email.
I feel
the
like
email I have to
I
check
sent you an
for
exciting
work
email
is,
recently.
Did you? Oh, come on. That's different. But also, like, you know, I'm not getting any, you know, there's no good news for me in my email, generally.
You get to go to
and
my wedding.
Email, it's true. But the email I get for work, you know, which is also, like, where, like, the money comes in, you know, like, that's the other maybe good thing you can get through email. That's, like, one email account. And all the other email, and it's only for work, and everything else is just like a tank load of garbage.
It does feel like whatever fun there can be in social interaction has fled email years ago and is now all on social media. I used to get emails from a friend like you being like, hey, did you see this funny record that came out or this movie?
Yeah.
You don't get those in there anymore.
Yeah, we don't share fun things with each other via email. Like, not just you and I, but I think we as a culture no longer do that.
No.
And I was thinking about it this afternoon, like, you know, hours before we recorded this live in the studio at midnight, that like I used to be part of like mailing lists. where I would like read about, you know, interact with people who were enthusiastic about the same things I was over email.
Yeah, and like a Yahoo Groups email. Like I had one of those for woodworking.
You know, certain flavors of Linux, the band Belle and Sebastian, you know, like this is the 90s, you know, but it's like I had these friends that I had made who lived in other places who we shared this common interest. And I would like read emails that they wrote about their lives and write them emails about that, respond to that. And we would have these little, conversations via email. And I do not, for the life of me, have any such interactions now. I am barely able to conduct sort of a very casual conversation with my uncle over email, who is still, you know, trying to like communicate via email as in this style that has now departed us. You know.
Yeah. No, I think, I mean, this is going to expose how old we are, but we even began this show via email.
No kidding. Yeah. Well, it was, you know, so it's like it, but, anyway, all the pleasure of reading email is gone and all the pleasure of attending the Freeze Art Fair is also gone. However, I did prioritize going to some parties and that never gets old. I love to party. And it's an excuse for people to sort of throw, more uncompromisingly lavish parties, I think, for larger numbers of people, because it's not in your benefit to like be really exclusive about guest lists, because you want people to come and make the party look good.
That's true.
You know,
that's true.
And you want to make sure that like people you don't personally know, but who might be cooler than the people you do know, decide to come to your party. You know, so it's like, so I went to like a very nice party till very late, at one of those houses off the PCH, like right on the beach in Santa Monica.
Ooh la la.
Under the cliff. It was a very nice house, I have to say. Like, and it's the kind of thing that like, this is funny actually. So like last weekend was also, admissions weekend for art schools in the area, which I didn't realize, but like, you know,
that means people who got into the school are coming to interview or no, sorry.
People haven't gotten in yet.
Okay. But they're interviewing.
They're interviewing. Yeah.
Okay.
So like Harley was, you know, at UCR, for example. But a friend of mine who's like a younger person had just done his CalArts interview and had met this like girl at their CalArts interview day. And like he had taken her to this beach party, you know. And I just remember a similar thing happening to me early on, maybe not actually on interview day at CalArts, but similarly, you know, very early on, going to these like weird parties in the hills and stuff and just being like, this is what's going to be like forever. I'm just going to be going to these parties all the time.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing is
they only want rich people and young people. And famous people, and like we're not really in any of those categories at the moment.
Yeah. Those I've really failed on all three counts.
Young,
and
rich,
so
or
like,
famous, and you're like, well, I don't got any of those at the moment. We were young back then. That's why we got in. we wrote emails.
I responded to the email saying yes, I will go to your party. Yeah. So it's like. Yeah. So like, you know, I was like with them and they were like, you know, still sort of like decompressed. I mean, good on this young fellow for, you know, sort of like getting a whole date together, you know, like it basically improvising a whole fancy date.
Did he did your friend meet this person at the interview?
Yes.
Oh, okay. That could be interesting.
Smooth. Yeah. Is what I'm saying. I think I wish him well. I hope they both get into school in Southern California and wish them all the happiness in the world. But it seems like things are going really well. It seems like taking this potential new resident of Southern California, I think she's coming from Chicago, to a party at the beach was a good move. I think it was working out well.
Yeah.
Anyway... so things like that. I was in an Ai Arakawa performance for a couple days.
Okay.
And then basically wrapped all that up on Saturday and then slept in all Sunday. And then I looked at the weather forecast and we experienced it today, but there's just going to be insane wind.
Yeah.
And rain. That's must be awful. Very windy where you are.
It
in
is.
The foothills,
and
right?
My brother sent me a video last night of, out in Joshua Tree. Staying
at
our family place. And he said the winds were like 60 miles an hour or something.
Yeah, they can really get going out there.
Yeah, the windows were rattling in a frightening way.
I mean, our windows rattle here too.
That's true, yeah. Depends on the orientation of the house, I suppose.
And the fastness of your windows, I think, as
yeah.
well.
Also true.
But, and I mean, you can even hear it whistling through the ventilation here at Kaechung.
Yeah.
No, indeed. But but yeah, let's go. But that let's go. Just to return to the topic of emails I've received that were in fact bearers of good news. Is there something you'd like to tell the people in Radioland?
It's true. I'm getting married to the ever lovely and wonderful Ella Gold. Next Friday.
Well, ladies, you can't have them anymore after next Friday.
It's true.
So,
yeah.
Make your plays, ladies.
It's true. And you know, it's
find him in Pasadena if you can.
Speaking of fortuitous email correspondences, I had met Ella before this, but the relationship was really solidified. The first date put in the calendar, telephone numbers exchanged. At a performance given by the Talking Show.
Wow.
So this show, you know, just to let everyone know that talking can lead to all kinds of things, including lifelong commitment to a beautiful person like Ella Gold.
So far, this is maybe the best outcome of the Talking Show, I would say. No, seriously, because it's pretty good in the scheme of things. You know, it's not world peace, but it's pretty good.
Yeah.
And neither of us it's made neither of us wealthy or famous, but if this is the only net positive to come out of the Talking Show, I think that's pretty good.
It's
you know,
true.
There's still a chance for fame. There's still a chance for fortune. You know, we're not done doing the show yet.
No chance for youth.
You know.
We'll see.
Who's to say what miracles science may or may not? You know, did you see Avatar 2? There's like a ooze from the space whale's brains that cancels human aging.
Oh, okay. So, and we have Solomon on our side, so
yeah, if anyone figures this out, it'll be Solomon. Yeah.
Well, one topic that we discuss far, far too seldom here on the Talking Show is the intricate and complex concept of love. So, you know, leading into this holy matrimony of mine, we've invited two experts on the subject to do a proper chinwag and let us all know what one should know these days about love. Put your hands together for Todd McGowan and Ryan Ingley.
I think it's too, we've done it too long for you to be asking this question.
Okay. All right. So let's
not,
go
I'm
on.
I'm not even going to give you an answer.
Okay.
No, no, it's no, I think early, I probably don't remember this, but like you genuinely asked me to be the host of the show.
Oh, okay. So
like in the beginning, okay. Like when we planned this, like how was it going to go? Like okay. Who was going to start talking?
Okay.
And so now it's been 5 years and you forgot that. And so now it seems like I made it up.
I see. Who asked. I asked you to dominate me and I forgot. Okay. All right. Let's get on.
And I acquiesced.
You acquiesced.
So who's,
yes. Okay.
So then who,
we're
then
in the, I think we're in the terrain of love, I think.
So. We're in for very much in the terrain of love. And, yes. And who has the dominant position?
Right.
Is it the person who asked to dominate or the person? I mean, there's so many different, yep. different ways. In fact, I mean, this might be, the episode to tell this. Well, maybe we were saving this for if we can get him on for another interview. But this might be the episode to tell the story of when I met Slavoj when he introduced us.
Yeah.
This might it'll come back to this conversation in the beginning. Right. So we are talking about love today. But before we talk about love, we have to talk about some unfortunate news. And to cut directly to the chase. Actually, no. To interrupt myself about the chase. Did you know, Todd? It took me until I was like 25 to know that that was like a phrase from. Like referencing movies.
Oh, really? Like cut to the chase.
Yeah, like the chase scene.
Yep, right.
Because I thought it was because when I was a kid, I knew what a chaser was.
Right.
You know, you have a horrible drink and then you have a drink after it. And I knew it because I hated my mother, who listens to this podcast regularly, will remember this. I hated taking medicine. I hated it.
So you wanted to cut to the chase. Dimetap.
Yes, exactly. Because my father called it a chaser. You could have you could have this thing after. So that's what I thought it was. But I still, even though I knew that, like, I don't know, it was like, I just kind of thought like, why, like if this you're telling me this thing is good for me, but it doesn't smell like Coca-Cola or chocolate milk.
Right. Why couldn't it be good?
Why is it? How is it?
That's interesting. Because I always misunderstood cut to the chase as throw a quick pass to Jamar Chase, but clearly, and now that's even sadder for me now, but clearly that was not correct.
That was not it. Yes. So to cut to the chase. So Todd and I will really devastatingly not be in person at the Impact Festival next week. We will be doing it remote. So everything we were going to do in person, we are still going to do, although we're not going to be there to be able to like talk with people. There were like two former students I was going to catch up with who were there and people had emailed and I have emailed them that I won't be there. A large part of the reason why we're not there is I broke my foot.
You broke
on my birthday.
Yeah.
October 14th, Battle of Hastings and also Pomona College's birthday, two important things, irrelevant things on that day, while out jogging. I think the crazier thing is that the next morning we recorded the last podcast while I was in searing foot pain and refusing to go to the hospital.
You're right. You hadn't gone to the hospital yet, right?
No, I hadn't. Right. So I'm officially the Ronnie Lott of podcasters. Right. I think that will mean something to like five listeners.
Maybe a few people.
Maybe a few people. Yeah. So,
I'm having to deal with my mother in being put into long-term Alzheimer's care. So that's another issue. So anyway,
that's another thing. Yeah. That's another thing. So those things happened the same week, which is a bummer. We're still going to be there via remote. And we're really excited to do that. And maybe, I don't know, maybe some other year we'll be able to get over there when I'm not out jogging on wet leaves or whatever was that ended up happening. So, that's the unfortunate news. And my foot apologizes, Todd. Yeah.
So the fortunate news is we still have time to talk about love, even though we have squandered a few minutes in this opening.
That's true. Yes. It's a little bit more grab ass than we typically do, but perhaps appropriate for the topic.
Perhaps. Perhaps.
Right. So obviously everyone knows that love didn't exist until Wesley and Buttercup kiss each other at the end of Princess Bride. So, but we're putting that to one side and we're looking more at, this as a philosophical and theoretical idea. And it's the conclusion of our, you know, three episode dalliance, with Baju and his work. Love is super important for him in a way that disrupts, I think, in a significant way, some of the tenets of his theory, which we will get to. But and I think that'll probably dominate the middle. Speaking of domination, it'll dominate the middle portion, I think, of our conversation. But we're going to start a little bit more historically with a really, really important concept that is very old about love that is still dominant.
Yeah,
and that is,
which is surprising.
The idea of complementarity. Right. So Todd, unfurl that. What does that mean, complementarity?
Right. So complementarity, interestingly, I think that this is the first articulation of it is in Plato's Symposium. And the Symposium, it's in French, it's known as Le Banquet, so the banquet. And it's basically a party where everyone who's invited gives a speech and then people... Or and they get drunk and they eat and they vote on, and then they have sex with each other and they and they vote on the the best, most impressive speech. So the Plato Symposium is a series of speeches that ends the highlight supposedly is Socrates' final speech on love. And it's basically his thing is about love of how love of beauty leads us to the truth. And then so love ends up being this vehicle for philosophy, basically. But no one really knows that because unless you're a Platonist or because that's not the one that people have paid attention to. People have paid attention to the speech that Plato gives to Aristophanes, who interestingly was a famous playwright, the most famous comedian in Athens, comic playwright. And he was famous for writing The Clouds, which was a play about Socrates, which I think it would be too much to say it got Socrates killed, but it certainly didn't portray him in a very, it would be too much to say, but I did say that. I did a kind of
it'd
a Trump. I wouldn't say but anyway.
It'd be too much to insist.
It would be too much, right. Right, but but Socrates played portrayed negatively. So it is interesting, at least, and many, many people have commented on this, why Plato would put what seems to be the best and most convincing speech in the mouth of the enemy of his mentor, who is Aristophanes. Anyway, that's we're not going to talk about that. We're going to talk about what that speech says. And as Ryan pointed out, it basically gives voice to the concept which totally dominates the romantic comedy genre and basically the action film as well, everything, drama and television and film and video games, which is the concept of complementarity. So Aristophanes' idea is this, that originally humans were whole. They were self-contained and they enjoyed themselves, for lack of a better word, they enjoyed themselves too much. And God was jealous. And God said, I don't want you to enjoy yourself so much. So God split every human being in two. And then the theory is kind of interesting. So, and this shows that Plato wasn't a heterosexist because God split every being in two. Some were on two sides women, some were on two sides men, and some were divided between man and woman. And then you desired that other part of you that would complete you. And so the notion, thus complementarity, the notion that we get articulated finally in Jerry Maguire, the movie, You Complete Me, actually has its origins in this myth that Aristophanes gives of the original splitting of the subject, basically, in Plato's Symposium. Just a little side note, at our wedding, Hillary and I had the judge read a little bit from Plato's Symposium and say, we're going to have a marriage not based on complementarity, which luckily no one said, wait a minute, Freud wrote this essay on negation. And so if you're so professing so loudly, it's not that, maybe there's a little problem, but no one said that. No one said that. Even my close friend, Paul Eisenstein, who was there talking.
I think he just didn't want to ruin your wedding.
Didn't want to ruin the wedding. But of course, if he really had paid attention to the rejection of complementarity, ruining the wedding would have been making the wedding. Fair enough. Right?
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, that's, I mean.
Paul's too nice of a guy is the lesson from that, I think.
That's the lesson. Oh, well, we finished a lot earlier than normal.
Yeah. Anyway, that's it. That's complementarity.
That is complementarity. And yeah, the Jerry Maguire example, I think perfect. You complete me we talked about this a long time ago. And when we did that, we talked a little bit about the, what was the film? I keep thinking Lady in the Lake, but that's not the name of it. The one that won Oscar, the Oscar instead of Get Out, or maybe that's the wrong year.
La La Land?
No. That was the.
I know the one you're talking about. In the Shape of Water.
You know what I'm talking
about? In the Shape
of
Water.
Water. Thanks so much. Okay. And so what Sally Hemings' character says is that the creature from the Black Lagoon kind of thing that film is playing with.
Far superior film, doesn't, but anyway, go ahead.
Far superior, absolutely. Yeah. Also Return of the Creature from
I agree. Superior. Agreed.
He doesn't see what she lacks. That's what she says.
Right.
And so, because she can't speak. That's the lack that she's speaking of.
Right.
Speaking of signing to her friend.
Right.
And so this even in like, again, like you said that, I mean, that's kind of more of an action film.
It's more of a drama action film.
Drama action. Yeah. It's still that idea is that like you lack something or someone else, like, or in a non theoretical sense of the term lack, there's like overlapping, like someone lacks something and another person lacks another thing and they make up for that, like for each other.
Right. And so they become a whole together.
Exactly. So right. They become a whole through that way. The puzzle pieces.
Right.
It's fitting.
It's fascinating too how rampant that idea is. Just like you're saying, like, so it crosses genre for sure. And mm-hmm. you would think, I mean, I think the impulse would be, oh, this is a heterosexist way of thinking. Mm-hmm. But I've seen many, many, many queer romantic comedies. The most recent one I saw was called Bros, and completely invested, same idea, right? Like equal investment as Jerry Maguire or When Harry Met Sally or any, you know, like I like some of these films, but not Jerry Maguire particularly, but they nonetheless have this real investment in this idea of complementarity, and it's the rare one. And what's interesting is the screwball comedy, which we've talked about quite a bit on this show, like bringing up Baby, for instance, or maybe it's just Howard Hawks, tends to do a good job of showing the failure of complementarity, right? Like that rather than being, it's like, instead of an excess and a lack fitting together, it's like the excess bangs into another excess and creates the whole Brontosaurus skeleton comes tumbling to the ground.
The intercostal clavicle.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So the bone, it's one bone too much rather than the bone that can be perfectly inserted. Sorry about, I didn't mean that to be so sexual. But I just started on it, and then I was like, "I don't. This is not going
to
go."
It took you down a path. It took sometimes you can give voice to an idea, and sometimes an idea voices you. And
The signifier took me where I didn't want to go.
It took you for a ride. Yeah. That's pretty good. So yeah, no, and I think this is part of maybe this gets too much in the weeds of genre film for a second, but I do think this is part of the reason why you don't see the screwball comedy as such anymore is that like the central idea is not as often plays out in romantic comedies today that like these two unlikely people actually fit perfectly together. That's the romantic comedy idea.
Yeah.
The screwball idea, as like Bring a Baby is the best example, which we talked about at length in the episode we did on screwball comedy, is that the love event, because we're eventually going to talk about Baju, it rips you apart, and you're not attracted to and pulled by the thing that would complete you, but it's you're attracted to and pulled toward the thing that undoes you,
right?
And that's what happens in the screwball comedy in general, and I think we're going to come back to this more at the end. We've mentioned this in the podcast too a long time ago. Alenka Zupancic has a really nice essay on Ernst Lubitsch and his films and the which she calls the love of the two, where like what happens is it's not in the screwball comedy or in Lubitsch, two don't become one, two become two, right. As in not they stay independent, which I think is one of the plot lines in He's Just Not That Into You. I think it's the Ben Affleck plot line. That's like kind of the idea is that like they stay independent. It's that the love, to use Baju's terms, I don't think she does, but in the essay, so I don't want to misrepresent it. But like the love event is this. It's this thing you have a relationship with. It's not that you have a relationship with another person. You have a relationship to both of you, to having fallen in love with each other, and that creates a possibility of subjectivity that could not exist otherwise.
Right.
And that's the two that you become. And she gives a nice example. We've given this as a lesson before, so it can't be the lesson to this podcast, of Clooney Brown, where the two characters in that film at the end, like they exist as a couple, but
squirrels to nuts.
Squirrels to nuts, like in a way that they couldn't with other people.
Right. Right. The maybe idea. Sorry, I just threw that out from nowhere. That in the film, what's his name's he's a professor. I forget his name, but he's like somebody. Yeah. People always say you got to bring nuts to the squirrels, but who's to say someone can bring squirrels to the nuts? Right. Like this reversal, this like disturbing thing that doesn't fit in with what everybody else does, and that's what he's drawn to in Clooney.
Yeah, because she's the one who says that.
Oh,
yeah.
She says it. Okay.
Good. She says that first, but then he says it at the end of the film to the workers in the house. So that's the thing that like it's a like I think that film maybe more than maybe than any other, it's a grandiose statement, more than any other screwball comedy is that like it's this person introduces a like really like a new way of being for you.
Right.
Like he wouldn't have thought that. Like it changed psychically him as a person. And it's like I think this is, you know, moving toward Baju and the idea of the love event. Like what's evental about it is that, you know, before you fall in love, like your day is whatever your day is, like, you know, it's more self-focused, or you go to work or whatever it is, because why wouldn't it be? Or you hang out with friends, like whatever it is, but then you fall in love and it's like, this is the thing I'm invested in now. It's the when Harry met Sally line, like you're the last person I want to speak to when I go to bed at night and the first person I want to speak to in the morning. Yeah. Like your day is like the way you organize your time
is organized around that person.
Exactly. Right. Around that. Like it's completely shifted. And I think that's an idea that we both find convincing. And I think that idea works with Alenka's and a psychoanalytic
for sure.
Understanding. There are some areas we're going to get to where for Baju that doesn't. And part of it is that he doesn't think, as we've said in the previous episode, he doesn't think we're subjects outside of the event. So you're only subjects.
Right. Right.
Of the event, and that I think you and I both have problems with. But just to go with...
Yeah, just to go for our little chronology that we're going on. So there's Plato, this notion of complementarity, which isn't necessarily Plato's idea. His idea is more love of truth, and that love is what takes us in the direction of truth. And then there's the what Badu would call the Christian event, right? Like, and I think that and it's real. So Christ, of course, talks a lot about love, but it's really, for Badu for sure, it's really Paul, famously in 1 Corinthians 13:13, where he says, faith, hope, and love, these three abide, but the greatest of these is love, right? This idea that that love is the thing that can be a new organizing principle, not just for you as an individual, but for the world. And I think that's the that's the Christian idea. Badu will militate against that idea of love. And what's interesting is the amount of opposition that now occasions. So Freud famously in Civilization's Discontent says, okay, you can have Christian love of all humanity as long as you have people left out of humanity that you can reserve for your hatred, right? So
yeah.
And he thinks that's true for communism as well. So, but I think in a way, Marx...
Just very quickly, the short story examples of that principle would be Shirley Jackson's The Lottery or The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas.
Right.
That would be the idea.
Like, absolutely.
There has to be someone excluded
right.
for there to be this universal love. That would be right. Freud's idea.
Anyway, absolutely. Marx, however, I think... Even though he would never put it in Christian terms, I think that the ethical position that drives his political philosophy is one of universal Christian love. I think that that's so. I think there's a way that Christian idea really keeps working up through Marx and via Hegel. I think so. I mean, I think one of the real dividing points among the thinkers that we'll talk about is. Is love reserved for a relationship, or is it possible to have a more universal idea of love? And for some, it's just the opposition between eros and agape, right? Like the a romantic love versus a love of humanity. And it's interesting. I think Saint Francis would be one of these great examples of agape and try to enact universal Christian love. But it does seem, I mean, I think it's a pretty convincing point by Freud and others that everybody that seems to try to evince universal love ends up keeping someone excluded from it, right? Like, I'll come back to this movie Bros that I saw. Like, so one of the ideas in the film is, you know, there's enough hate in the world. Let's just have universal love. Right. And that's just, and so it's a, you know, nice Christian idea, but there's no working class. The people who are figures of hate are these working class people that are excluded from the, just for, they're just out of the mise-en-scene in the film. So it seems to me difficult. Like today, I think the liberal position is let's have universal acceptance and love of everybody, right? Like everybody,
sure,
except for the basket of deplorables that can't be redeemed, right? Like I think that
yeah. But isn't this so? This is interesting because again, another screwball comedy thing. To just pull it back to that, yeah, is class is always a part of the screwball comedy,
right?
Like Clooney Brown, she's like a low wage, like plumber. Worker. Like she's a plumber. I think, excuse me. Like, maybe they're both middle class and bringing a baby because he's a scientist and she's like a heiress or something. Right. Like the, but then, you know, and then
there's a Girl Friday there, but they're newspaper reporters.
Both newspaper reporters, that's clearly working class. Like, and then Philadelphia Story really stages the working class thing. Although at the end, of course, people stay in their class.
Right.
But it's at the very least like classes there where like I love When Harry Met Sally, but the idea of money and work.
Right.
It's just not a problem in that film. Like it's never a problem.
Right.
And to the extent that like Harry has a friend who's a writer.
He does.
Who, you know, and like just how does he make enough money writing? Like
to live in Manhattan? I guess he does, right?
Like I guess he does. Yeah, doesn't matter.
Right.
Maybe it's a rent controlled apartment in the 90s. Maybe there are a lot more, you know, there are more.
I think the most egregious example of what you're talking about is You've Got Mail, because Tom Hanks drives Meg Ryan's character out of business. She's runs a little bookshop, and then she just doesn't work for 6 months, right? Like it's just, and you're like, well, wait a minute. You're living in Manhattan. Your little crappy bookstore that didn't sell enough books in the first place is out of business. What are you living on exactly? And it's just not a question. The film
just not a question, but it does go to this point, which is like I don't think this is a particular point or a particularist point about like Hollywood film, but it is interesting to bring in the political like the liberal political that like as the idea of class has fallen out of consideration, out of mise-en-scene, out of the picture, out of the frame in the romantic comedy, like so too has class as a barrier or as a point of contradiction in love fallen out of like the dominant notions in society.
Right.
Like I think it's not a causal relationship. It's not like, oh, if only we had films where class was front and center, then we wouldn't feel this way in society. It's just, they're coextensive.
Right. Cause you could say it the other way around, right? You could say if we had those things, then we'd have the films. Right.
Yeah, exactly. Right. I think so. So it's more that the films are a synecdoche for the general idea, which is that like class considerations are not a part of the dominant notions of love. Like, I mean, you can even any of the, you know, Mari Rudy does such a wonderful job of taking down the like self-help, like love book industry in her book, The Case for Falling in Love.
Yeah.
And it's, I don't know exactly if she makes this point, but it'd be sympathetic with her her inquiry to say that like class is never in those books either.
That's like, she makes that point.
She does make that point. Okay. I did not remember. I read it when she came to give the talk.
It's such a good book. I mean, she's like, I once introduced her somewhere and I said, you know, the rest of us kind of screw around, but she like really sells a number of books, and it's true. Like, she wrote books that like a real number of people read, not like what we do. And that's one of them, Case for Falling in Love. And the other one is called Summons of Love, I think. And we'll get to Mari a little bit later. Sorry, I derailed us on that. But
no, it's okay.
I do think that I want to, even though I've just announced the critiques of this idea of universal love, I think it has to be insisted on and redeemed. And I think the modern version of it is fraternité from the French Revolution and Haitian Revolution, right? Like that is I think if you don't have that notion, and obviously there's a difference between universal love and romantic love, clearly. But I still think if you don't have some notion of the solidarity of everyone, like this love of everyone, then I think it's a couple things. I think you're going to think that some people can be disposable for accomplishing a certain political end. And I think,
or need to be
correct. Or we, to create our political end or our utopia, whatever, we have to have certain people outside. So I think those are two different versions of the same thing, right? Like one excludes and the other eliminates. But I think in both cases, that's the danger of not sticking to this idea of universal love that gets its first articulation in Christianity, but then gets an articulation I think you could say it, and some people have said this, that there's already these intimations of it in Judaism, even though there's also a sense of a people, right? But there is also this idea of a universal love and God as the figure of universal love. So I think that that's, you know, the invention of a loving God is the great Jewish invention, right? Like that's I think that from that you get this idea of universal, like that love can't be excluding, and if you think it can't be excluding, then you also have to think it can't be inclusive. And I think that's where liberalism always gets tripped up, that it wants to be inclusive, and I think you have to reject inclusion and universal because inclusion can never be universal.
Can you spend a little? So I want you to spend a little bit more time on that point, and I'm going to set it up by saying this, that the idea that there is a villain to some, I think we've said this before, but just to put it in this context, the idea that some points of view are villainous for the thing you want to do. It doesn't matter who you're saying is the villain. That's a conservative project.
Yes.
I think that would be the point of this podcast, which would be like I think probably the best example.
Incompatible with the idea of universal love. Yeah.
Incompatible with the idea of universal love or in the idea of universality. I think the best example of this is like, look, there's not a single person who's been canceled that I don't think should have been, that I think shouldn't have been canceled. But like, I think what's the most the best success of canceling is probably Harvey Weinstein, and I'm not going to say who this is because I don't know who would be so determined to find out this person, but I have a friend who's a former student who is works as a model in LA, and what she tells me about doing low like level like films is that maybe for like the higher level of film sets that like things are better and more equitable on set, but what's happening in like the lower rungs is that these like younger directors are trying to normalize like really creepy behavior earlier. Like that's just something that she's picked up
interesting
on. And like, and so I'm not saying that's not the effect, but the whole point is that like Weinstein gets taken down. That's great, like a 100%, but that doesn't alter the system. You cannot cancel enough bad actors to cancel the system that allowed them to act that way. That's the lure of it is that like, well, if we and I mean, this is the whole point. This is what we're saying about like love and universal love. It's like, oh, if we could just get the bad people out,
right?
Well, it's like how isn't that like that's every conservative ad for the politics that I'm seeing on TV and that everyone in this country is if you're in this country you see that's everything. It's like just because you are saying like, no, but the conservatives are the bad people. That doesn't matter. Structurally, you're doing the same project. And that's how conservatism is so like there. Conservatism is never so successful than when it limits the horizon of possibility for the left. And how does it limit the horizon of possibility for the left? It makes you start thinking in its terms. And if you start thinking in its terms, like, well, no, yes, there are villains, but they're the people on the right, then you've agreed with their basic premise. And then it seems arbitrary. Why are you saying I'm the bad guy? I think you're the bad guy because you're making me. There's some ad for Massachusetts here. It's like, what are kids learning in school? Not history, but they can name all 82 genders. It's like, that's insane. That's not even correct either, I don't think. But that's the game you end up playing if you start fighting in that terrain. That's the people who think that are the villain. We just need to get them out and things will be fine. It's like, no, they think you're the villain. So it's just like the Spider-Man meme of pointing at each other, and we need to get out of that, like sort of locked into cynical circles. So the statement that you made that occasioned me saying that, please go back to it.
Yeah. So. I think the idea is that you can never include your way to universality. Love can never be inclusive, right? Like it has to be, and I think this is the Christian idea. Like when Christ says, I think this is Matthew 19:24 or something. It's harder for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven than for a camel to enter the eye of the needle, right? Like let me just tell you, I might have said this on this show before, but when I grew up fundamentalist, so I know all these things in my heart because of that. But my mom spent a whole month of Bible study on this one verse because it was so troubling to the, you know, because they also accepted this gospel of wealth bullshit. And so she came back to me and she's like, you know, this is what she learned from her study. When learn, I put in quotation marks. So she learned that, okay, there's this place called the needle, and it's a place that where for a camel to pass through, the camel has to duck down to get beyond it. So the idea of that verse, Christ was just saying that he's using the definite article. For a camel to pass through the eye of the needle, it has to humble itself. And that you can still keep your money, but you just have to humble yourself and then you can get through. And then
that's amazing.
It's amazing. It's an amazing interpretive act, right? It's just like that minister should be really well compensated or should have been. but in college, I learned, Koine Greek, which is what the Bible was, New Testament was written in. And, there's no definite article there. It's an indefinite article. So it's complete. It's just complete nonsense, right? Like, so.
That's just so funny. It's like, there was a nightclub called The Needle.
I know.
You just, I don't know, whatever.
Yeah, you could play that game. You could play that game all day and all night. Right? So anyway, so.
Yeah.
But the point is, I think that it's only those who don't have, right? Like it's that there's an opposition between that. Love is for those who are excluded, not for all this group we're going to put in. And I think I think Christ comes back to that idea again and again and again and again, which is again, one way I think Paul I think there's this inclusive idea in Paul that, violates the Christian idea, which I don't think, any of the current what would you call them? Apologists for Paul, accept, right? Mm. Like they see Paul as they see Paul as the Lenin of Christ, right? Like that Paul, like Christ is Marx and, you know, Paul is Lenin. And I think they think him as someone trying to put into practice Christ's idea. But I think there's a real violation of the Christian idea in Paul because it's precisely this, like, I'm going to create a new group, although there is neither Jew nor Greek. Okay. There's this idea of like, there's no identity, but there's still, inclusion of those who believe and an exclusion of those who don't believe, who are gnashing their teeth, right? Like, I think so. And I think that that's not there in Christ. There's an embrace rather of the, you know, the meek will inherit, like the whole Beatitudes are about the, those, precisely those people who are exiled. And the point is that there's no limit on exclusion, right? Like, you don't, to be excluded, you don't need, and the inclusion, the those who are included can be an empty set. And I think that's the, unlike inclusion, which needs the excluded.
Those who can be included can be an empty set. Is that what you said?
Yeah. Yeah.
I like that. Yeah. That's pretty good, because the, I think the, you don't want to create, you know, this isn't this the, you said basket of deplorables, and then I was talking about canceling. Isn't the problem is that, like, those phrases, and then oftentimes with canceling, is that actually just creates another market,
right?
For precisely all, like either that person or all of those people. Like, it's like that phrase is, like, that phrase was unifying for,
right. Like, who are you playing for?
For Trump,
right? Who are you playing for? Right? Like, it's like, it's like if you're watching a sports event and you're seeing the player consistently do things that benefit the other team. That's what, when people say things like basket of deplorables, you're like, who are you playing for? Like, what is? What are you doing?
It's because you can't play. And I think so. I'm just trying to be really, really crystal clear on some of the ideas, is that, like, that. So, like, obviously, like so that's a high profile and I think very well known political example. So that makes it a good one. The Hillary Clinton talking about the basket of deplorables, and the way that it was really funny, like the way that people justified her saying that after the fact. I remember seeing this all over the place. Is like, well, no, but if you look, she's referring to this. There's this poll, and like you can see how many people on the right actually support racism. So she's talking about these people, and it's like you're just like that's the like the whole like you like the whole idea that conservatives run everything on in this country and the world over is that like. The left are just the same as conservatives, only they pretend to have elitist like values, like universal acceptance, but they really just exclude people. That's just what they do. And they're capitalists too. And like, that's when you're Hillary Clinton and you're a very good capitalist, like you can't say a thing like that, because it just, it gives too much truth to that. Yeah. And of course, Hillary Clinton, nowhere near the same politically as Trump. But the point that it doesn't matter. Like you could have, it could be 1% difference. It could be 40% different. It could be 50%. Like it doesn't matter what the percentage is. Conservatives dine out on there being any amount of similarity between their position and the left. And it's like, this drives people in the mainstream left like crazy. Like, how do they keep winning when they're so hateful or whatever? Is that they just say, you do the same thing. We're the ones who are being honest about it.
Right. Right.
That's the basis of the appeal. And it's, and again, it's like that to people who vote that way, that actually seems more like it seems more honest. And I think it would seem more inclusive. So what you're talking about is that inclusivity as a theoretical idea and the way that it's practiced in liberal democracies relies upon a kind of exclusion.
That's right.
And that project can never be emancipatory, and it can never be universal.
Or it can only be loving in the sense that Freud attacks, right? Like loving in the sense of I'm going to love those who are in and hate those that are out.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, let's.
So that's not a way forward.
That's not a way forward. And I think it's interesting that who's the great philosopher of love and of Christianity? It's Hegel, right? And I think Hegel precisely, I think it's pretty clear that so he writes this little piece on love, and he talks about Christianity as a religion of love in the late 1790s. And then it seems to me clear that by 1812, when he writes The Science of Logic, that the concept, what he thinks is the concept, comes out of how he understands love. Because love is finding oneself in otherness. It's this ability to see oneself within the other. Like, here's what he says in this little love thing. He says, love can occur only against the same, against the mirror, against the echo of our essence. So it's this coming out of oneself and finding oneself in otherness. And so for Hegel, that's really, there's an interesting thing that that what love does is what philosophy does, right? Like, or the concept does. Like, it's this coming out of oneself, finding oneself in this absolute strangeness of the other.
That's fantastic. So like where we've moved from, and I think that this is why the political has gotten kind of wrapped into this idea of love, is we started with the idea of love as completion and complementarity. And in politics, it seems to be like what's the obstacle to completion and complementarity? Well, we just need to eliminate that. And so what we would call that contradiction.
Right. Right.
And what we're moving to, and like what Hegel mobilizes really nicely, is actually like he's putting in the forefront the contradiction of the self, is seeing yourself as other, is the, like, that's the royal road to love, perhaps would be.
Right. Be the, right. Be the no, it's exactly true. Right. Like for Hegel, and I think this is true, I think love to me is the easiest way to understand contradiction. Like, if you believe love is possible, then you believe that contradiction is actual, right? Because isn't what happens in love is I elevate someone else in importance over myself. That's what it means. I think that's what it means to love someone. And we would all, I don't think that's a controversial definition. But why does that person, or who accounts for that person being elevated? It's me. So I'm doing this thing that takes away my own power to do the thing. Right. So it's exact enactment of contradiction, which I think is fascinating. Right. Like, and I think that's why Hegel was so, when he discovered, he had this early period where he was very, very antagonistic to Christianity. And he believed in Kantian duty, and that duty came before religion, et cetera. And love had no place in his thinking. And then all of a sudden undergoes this break. And what's fascinating is it coincides with this affair. No one knows whether this is consummated. And most people think it was his first affair. Most people think it was consummated with this woman, Nadette Endell. And it's right at this time he embraces Christianity. He turns away from Kantian religion of duty, right? And adopts a belief in love. And it is a fascinating thing that it coincides with this actual, I've always thought that you could, if you're a materialist, you would say, okay, he had the affair and then he, you know, his thought followed from that. But if you're an idealist Hegelian, you'd say, oh, his thought changed. Then, oh, he could have an affair because of that, right? I think it's
that's
a nice
interesting.
Little,
like, yeah. I think that's nice. Well, it's, I mean, I don't know. Does it? I don't know that it matters which, how, you know, which one was the cause of the other.
No.
But don't you think that it's an interesting, like, it's an interesting thing to consider, which is that like neither occur without that possibility of love, without falling in love.
Right.
And I think that's pretty fascinating. Like, so he saw himself as other in that affair. I mean, like, you do kind of have to abandon Kantian, certainly at least Kantian, like, moral
duty for sure.
To see yourself that
because
way.
Kant,
that's pretty.
Kant did not believe in fornication. I mean, Kant never had sex, but Kant did not believe in fornication. And his description of marriage in the Metaphysics of Morals is fascinating, right? A lot of people, Slavoj likes it, but most people hate it because his idea is that marriage is the mutual renting of the other person's sexual organs. And Kant thought that you could not have moral sex outside of marriage because you didn't have this contract that would allow for the mutuality. So he thought, and it's an interesting position. It's not crazy. like it, his position was one person's always going to get used if it's not in a marriage relationship. So, so he did not think you could have ethical sex outside of marriage. And Hegel obviously thought with this affair, he all of a sudden thought that you could, right?
Doesn't he say in a footnote somewhere like never trust the philosopher who doesn't fuck? I swear to God, he says that somewhere.
Really?
You
have to find
that. I just made that up.
That's pretty great. Yeah, that's pretty great.
Yeah, that'd be a pretty funny bit of graffiti.
Yeah.
Never trust a philosopher who doesn't fuck. Line under it, Hegel. You know, right?
That'd be pretty great. Although, you know, there'd be a lot of philosophers not to trust, wouldn't there?
You know what, Todd? Maybe that's a way to figure out who are your philosophers.
Wouldn't you have to go the other way? Like, also don't trust those who fuck too much.
Who avow? Well, I mean,
like then Lacan's like out. I think, right? Like he's
a Byron kind of.
Yeah, like Byron's out. Lacan's out. You know this thing about Lacan that even though he was like totally into his amorous life, he had a very disappointing love life. Do you know why that is? Because his wife didn't believe in the sexual relationship. His mistress only let him use a symbolic phallus, and every time he went to a prostitute, she'd only give him a short session.
I can't believe I set you up for that. So, that was great.
Okay. Brian has not heard this joke before that time, so I've been saving it. I was going to tell you in like private and then repeat it, but I wanted to just.
Oh my God.
Can I also say something? I have gotten a little feedback that my Badu joke from last week was pretty good, and that you just lacked a sense of humor in your response.
Oh, is that right?
I'm just kidding. No.
Oh, okay.
But I'm glad you appreciated this one. That's all that matters.
Well, no, it was good. That was it was earned. It was a good setup. Okay. It was it grew organically
out of the conversation.
Perfect.
I just made it up on the spot and didn't spend like 3 weeks honing that down.
Yeah, let's leave the process work that's pretty funny. All right, so I think that makes a nice that's a nice movement. So Badu, we kind of set this up a little bit.
Do you want to mention Lacan first? Because just chronologically.
No,
you want to go Badu first. Okay.
I want to go Badu first because I think what's important is to again get back into the like what's the objection?
Yeah, yeah.
And
good.
Like the it seems like you can talk about we're gonna do this. Like it seems like what Badu says is totally complementary of psychoanalysis, but like I think it's important that it's not, and to show where those lines are. So I want to move to Badu. Can I again reference the philosophy and the event?
I know. It's your favorite Badu book.
It's my favorite, because I just think it's very, very clear. Yes. Like this is great. So here we go. Love is essentially when there are two. This is if anyone has it. A stolen copy or a legitimate copy. I think it's on page 39. Yeah, 39. Love is essentially when there are two, rather than one, who experientially experiment with the world. Love is in no way formed than through a reduction of two to one. This is the romantic fusional concept of lovers merging in a supreme ecstatic unity, what we've been saying is complementarity, ecstatic unity whose only truth is death. This is a little bit different from what we've been saying. Whose only truth is death, as illustrated by Tristan and Isolde. I think, on the contrary, that love splits each individual's narcissistic unity in such a way that it opens up an experience of the world that is taken on as the experience of the two. I've named love the scene of the two. Whereas politics takes difference as its material and attempts to construct a minimal operative unity within this element, love, on the contrary, shatters the primary units and establishes the reign of the two over the experience of the world. And I think you can hear that and think that makes a lot of sense. He's rejecting complementarity. That sounds a little bit like screwball comedy. Yep. It's about the two.
Right.
It's not about this one unit. It's about this It's even about contradiction, because it's rejecting a kind of a narcissistic unity, as he puts it. So maybe there's an openness to contradiction, but there are some lines here. There's some lines of tension.
Right.
What are they talking
about? Well, I just want to follow up on what you said, because I think you're right. This is the best expression of love comes from there. But his most best-selling book is In Praise of Love, and he says the same thing. Mm. Like, he says, love contains an initial element that separates, dislocates, differentiates. You have two. Love involves two. So this is a constant refrain for him. Mm-hmm. And I think what's interesting, isn't it, that he thinks that there's he even calls it a narcissistic unity, right? Like we've talked about a lot of things on this podcast. And one of the things we talk about is that there's no initial unity of the subject. Mm-hmm. So he doesn't,
that's it.
I mean, it seems fascinating. And I think it comes back to his rejection of a subject of the signifier. There's no initial subjectivity. Subjectivity only forms and is constituted through an evental possibility, right? And so so I think that, to me, that's the big problem, that there already is a two. That is the subject itself. It's already divided against itself. And that's,
but he does not, and this is really, really important, but he does not accept the idea of the unconscious. And I think it seems simple, but like, you can't, if you don't have the unconscious in your system, then he has to have this position.
Yeah, but,
and so that's why, like I said in the previous episode, why I like him is that, like, he follows his own logic, although there are some issues here that are probably worth going into, but like, he doesn't think we are subjects outside of an event.
I know,
and
but so Ryan, he would definitely, if you said to him, you don't believe in the unconscious, he would say, oh, that's crazy. Absolutely. I believe in the unconscious. But I think your point is, if you don't think that there is a subject of the signifier, then no matter what you say, you don't really believe in the unconscious, right? If you don't believe there's a divided subject of the signifier, then you don't really acknowledge or avow or integrate into your system the importance of the unconscious, right? I think that's the thing. Like, no matter what he says, and I think that that's really crucial, because I think it has to, what's fascinating to me is how love plays this. I think we've said this before, that love is the paradigmatic event for Badu. I think it's absolutely correct. Even though it's the one event, it's the one event that's different than all the other events too, right? The kids doesn't, because it's not collective. But so that, and love is paradigmatic for conceptual thinking for Hegel. So there's a way in which they're the two philosophers most bonded together around the idea of love. And yet I think in a way, love shows how absolutely opposed Hegel and Badu are. So for Hegel, love is about this torsion of contradiction. And for Badu, it's about the assertion of difference. And like, and so for Hegel, love is constantly showing us how contradiction underlies difference. And for Badu, love shows us how difference underlies unity. And I think those are, so it's not just an opposition, right? It's just two different ways of conceiving things. But I think it's an absolutely fascinating way to understand each thinker in terms of love, and also showing two totally different conceptions of what love is. One, a philosophy of contradiction, the other, a philosophy of difference. And it ironically shows the proximity between Badu and Deleuze, I think.
Interesting. I think you're right. I mean, that's really interesting. I mean, for one thing I wanted to nail down is, I think I've said in the past, and or we've said in the past, that a nice way to think about the unconscious is that we are subjects of the unconscious, and that we are subjected to the unconscious. Mm-hmm. And I think what I like what you did is that it putting the signifier in there, like that would be the way you could be aware of that.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah,
because you can't be aware, like, you can't have this meta, like, oh, I'm acting unconsciously right now. Like, you can, that can't happen. Right. But what you can, I think you can have some minimal distance to is like to see how you are subject of the signifier and subjected to the signifier.
Absolutely.
And in that, you know, like again, it's why I think I said this on Neil Gorman's podcast. Hi, Neil. That like I would rather stab. This is kind of funny. I'll actually change it. I would rather break my foot. I'd rather break my fifth metatarsal slightly lower than the joint again than to see like students do an impression of me, because then I would see how I signify.
Right.
You know what I
right.
mean? Like, right. like I just, right. I don't want to see that.
Right.
It's the same reason why you don't want your kids to see you teaching.
Absolutely.
Right.
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 So it's, but it's anyway, but that's, I think that's really important because so, and I, you could see the proximity for of Badiou to Deleuze would happen on different lines for different reasons. Is that, you know, Badiou is opposed to I mean, this the body without organs thing I think is the best example. Is that like anything that determines that he would say like determines who you are.
Right.
He does not have time for. He wants to escape that.
Right.
Every major idea of Badiou's is a flight from contradiction.
Right.
Like through his whole, like the absolute novelty of the series, like repetition, the way he looks at it is.
You mean Deleuze? I think you said Badiou. You mean Deleuze?
Oh, okay. Sorry. Deleuze. Yeah. Absolute novelty in the series, repetition generating difference, which like it's really funny. But both of those two ideas put together is that like what Deleuze doesn't have in his system is that like the shock of the new can get very old.
Right.
you know, and I think that's like a very important like you have to think about that to have that idea. Like that would be the contradiction arising from that
right.
system that he would have to deal with. So I think it's I don't know that I would. It's not as, I don't think it's as evident in Badiou's work. I don't think that the flight, what I think is really valuable in Deleuze's work is that like the flight from contradiction that always appears, it like shows you how present and important, like it actually graphically shows you contradiction in like, because he moves away from it. Like it's in the cinema books, you know, the any place wherever like and like anything that organizes that does this determinative right. thing like that shows right. you where contradiction
right. and,
is
and Badiou
Deleuze.
Isn't
he
allergic
tries to sidestep
to,
it.
Right he's not allergic to no, form he, in that way
it's,
right
I don't think so yeah I don't think so I think it happens differently I think it happens a lot more slyly
yeah
for Badiou like the this sort of sidestep that's here that like that you he has the scene of the two and the like the love event, which about we wanted to make sure to mention this, that like he does a really nice job of separating love from reproduction, which is very nice.
Right. Right. I know that, yeah. you know, oftentimes people are critical of him for being heterosexist or whatever, but I think he's pretty good on this actually. Like I think he, in Praise of Love, he really says, you know, whatever gender is involved in love. And I mean, the only thing is that he does insist he would be against the throuple. Like, I mean, I don't think there's any
which
question.
Doesn't, yeah. I don't think his system can sustain that objection.
Yeah. That's an interesting, like, so let's, can we talk about that? Cause that's an interesting
sure.
point that you're raising that, why wouldn't it be? So anyway, so he says that love is an event of the two, right? That's why he doesn't believe in universal love. We've talked about that.
Right.
Despite mm-hmm. the love of the embrace of St. Paul, he doesn't believe in universal love, which is mm-hmm. ironic. And he also doesn't believe in polyamory, or he doesn't believe in the
right.
throuple. He's very clear about that in Praise of Love. He also says an interesting thing that he's never given up on any of his own love events except the first one. So he's being autobiographical. And that seems difficult to reconcile with the being against polyamory position, except yeah. I think what he would say is I'm a unique subject with every one of those lovers, but we don't right. all come together. I think that's what, I mean, obviously that's what he would say. Anyway,
yeah,
so why do you think it's theoretically not indicated by his system?
Yeah, so I don't think that he has a mechanism in this idea to uh, to to cast that out. I think he's only left with assertion.
All right.
And the reason why I say that is that since we're not subjects for Baju, like that's the thing. That's that sort of like sly step where like you can see that this working with you could if you because he doesn't. Because he makes the subject of the two front and center, like you think, oh, he's a thinker of subjectivity, but he's not. He's a thinker of the event, and that's it's only because of the event that he can conceive of subjectivity at all. So that would be like that's like the very clear objection on the psychoanalytic side. So why I don't think it's kind of the same reason for the like why just four truth procedures is and not five. Why not a sixth, and right, why not right. just three? Well, I'll tell you why there's four, because the other three come from the outside. And this is the one that comes that's something that like that you could do as a individual subject, right, but like maybe right. I'll just use the word individual. And I think according to that logic, I don't know why someone who only comes into subjectivity through the event, why does that structurally exclude the notion that two people in a couple could meet a third person who they think like that's another event? I don't see structurally how he could exclude that,
right? No,
from the system, it doesn't. Like, I don't know why. Like, why can't it be the scene of the three? Right, and I think that's the kind of the problem is that like. There's no reason. I don't think there's a reason in what he's written for why there can't be a scene of the three. And then for same reason, I don't think there's any reason why there can't be a scene of the four and the five. It's just sort of the same thing. Like you kind of come back to that that line that Ed Plouffe had in his book on Baju, which is that like, you know, Baju is open. Like he doesn't say he doesn't have any like. There's not an ontological or existential requirement that set theory be involved in these things. Nor is there an existential or ontological requirement why there are four truth procedures. However, if we proceed with the idea that there are four, these are the things that we can see and understand. And I think that would be the only answer you could say. This is that like with the idea of love as it, just for a couple, like we can see more in the intersubjective dynamic than we can if we added a third or a fourth person. But then I would say, also like if his idea, I actually think he already makes the argument for what that would look like within his system. If he says that he's a different subject of the event with every lover, that kind of serial monogamy, I think that's just, that would be the argument for what would like a Bedouin theory of polygamy look like is like you right. are a different subject with each person. So right. I think that is the reason why not only does structurally he not have a reason for excluding polyamory. I think he makes the argument for what polyamory would look like theoretically within his system.
That interesting. Interesting. Yeah. I don't have any objection to that. Like, I think that that's because I guess for me, like, I think that I think you run into this problem of contingency or arbitrariness. I know those aren't the same thing. When you insist upon difference and to the exclusion of contradiction, right? Like and I think if you don't see the contradiction involved with love, and I think the Hegelian argument against polyamory would be not that he would be against it.
Just to be really clear from what you're about to say, not the Hegelian argument against polyamory, like polyamorous relationships, the Hegelian argument against polyamory as being part of like the theoretical idea
of love. Who cares what polyamory, right? Yeah.
Wait a minute. Wait, Todd, the great line from, I think was it Animal Crackers is, Groucho is talking to a woman and I think he's in a relationship with the Margaret Dumont character, and he says that they should go out with this other woman, and she says, "Why, that's big of me." He says, "Of course it is. It's big of me too. It's big of all of us. We should be big for a change. Why be small all the time?"
There you go. There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, so I think the reason why Hegel would not want to would say that polyamory is not part of what he would think of as love is because I think that it's the multiplicity precisely obfuscates the contradiction. Right, like, mm-hmm. like, yeah, because yeah, yeah. if you're like just the logic I gave, right, that the subject elevates this other person above themselves, and thus they're doing the elevating, and yet the other person's above them, thus a contradiction. But if there's two, then all of a sudden that doesn't work out quite so easily, and then all of a sudden it's hidden underneath difference. But I think you're right. Like, for a philosopher of difference, ontological difference, like Badu, I don't think it's such a problem. And so I think you're right. No. Like, I think he should be and want to have a more expansive idea of love than he does. Which is funny, because when I've brought Badu into teaching, that's the objection that students tend to have, is that his notion of the love event is too confined. They think it's heterosex. I think it's wrong to say it's heterosexist. I think he's pretty good about that.
Sure.
But I think it is true that it rejects the three, and I don't think he should, just like you said, I totally follow you on this. I don't think that he should. Like, I don't think theoretically that he should.
Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't, because he would make the, because then it would be really interesting if he did, because then you could say, like, oh, okay, well, so then he's on the side of the way that, like, the polyamorous relationship works is that, like, when there's a third person or fourth or whatever, it doesn't matter, that, like, you're looking at different subjectivity.
Yeah.
Okay. And then you could have, that's on one side, is that, like, it's this explosion of subjectivity. Yeah. Let's just say that. And then on the other side, you would position the, like, the Hegelian thing, which is like, okay, how you would ask Badu, so now make, and maybe this is precisely the reason why he doesn't include it, is to say, like, okay, but now make the case for how what you're saying as the explosion, or what you're positing, and again, he doesn't posit this, I'm making him posit this, because right. I'm following right. his own logic, just to be very clear. But so this would be what you would do for the argument, is that, like, okay, so now make the case that this explosion of, like, subjectivity within the polyamorous relationship isn't simply the turning away of contradiction, that it's not just showing, like, and because I think you can have the like the Hegelian idea, and it would be operative in this, I don't know, polyamorous theory, is that, like, is it just like when the two when the contradiction seems to be intractable, that's when the third or the fourth or the fifth becomes attractive?
Yeah.
Like,
I think that's what Hegel would say.
Well, that's what Hegel would say if Badu said the thing that I'm thinking or I'm arguing that he should say based on following his logic. Right. Yeah. So I think it's interesting, Ryan, because
there should be this great Hegelian argument versus Badu. We should even have it staged. Like, we could revive, we could, like, use like video evidence from Hegel and, like, you know, like they did with Philip Seymour Hoffman in Hunger Games, make him in the debate, and they could have this debate about polyamory versus contradictory love, right? And I think but Badu wouldn't do that, but I think he I think you're absolutely right to say that he should, like, that should be his position. I mean,
it'd be really interesting.
I mean, I think it would get him a lot more followers, actually. Like, I think it would be a good marketing strategy on his part. But
at its most cynical, it would at least.
But actually, I think that's part of why he doesn't do it, frankly.
Yeah,
I think there's a kind of, like, you know, it would be too a la mode, right? And I think he doesn't want to. Mm. I think he wants, for better or worse, that he wants to avoid that.
For better or worse,
yeah.
It is interesting. Either way, like, I think, like, what I think we're positioning is that, like, contradiction as we often do, but I think it operates like most clearly. This was your claim, and I think you're right about this. It operates most clearly in the love tie, and part. So this is where I think Lacan is interesting. Yeah. And I think you have to have a notion of the signifier being subjected to, subject of, and the unconscious being subject of, subjected to. He has this line that you and I love the first half of and do not like the
second
half. Not like
the end of it at all. I know.
At all.
Slavoj likes it. I know. And I think he's wrong to like it. But go ahead.
I think, So we'll work on it. It's at the end of Seminar 11, where he says that love is and apologies if I'm getting some of the words wrong, but love is giving what you haven't got to someone who doesn't want it.
Yeah.
And we love the first part. I don't think we like the second part. It doesn't, I think that the last part, the reason why I don't like the last part is not that it maybe isn't even that I think the idea is bad. It's just, it's too like, that's like a tweet. Like it's too snappy. Right, like it doesn't right. like the idea doesn't, I don't know what the idea is in that. It's, it makes a lot more sense to me to say, love is giving what you haven't got to someone, to someone for whom it would tear them apart to receive it.
Right.
Like that makes a lot more sense. And that's like right. a lot more consistent with even what he thinks and what psychoanalytic theory would
agree
say.
Totally.
Like, that
I think
would be the idea
on this idea. I think Joy Division puts it a little bit better than Lacan does.
Oh yes.
I think so. Right. Like I think Badu is
love will tear us apart.
Yeah. Love will tear us apart. I think that, you know, what's interesting. There's two mixes of that song and one where you can understand the lyrics totally. And the other where you can't understand them at all, except for love will tear us apart. And the one where you can't understand is just better. And it's a fascinating thing where you're like, wait a minute. It's one of these great objet a things, right? Like you want to hear it. You want to hear it. And then you hear it. And you're like, well, those are great lyrics, but I like not hearing it better.
No, it's great. Anyway, it's really, really nice.
Anyway, but I think that like that you're exact. It's so well put by you that it's not that you don't want it. It's that when you get, and this is why maybe you do want it unconsciously, right? Like it's utterly disruptive to be loved. And I think Badu is also very good on this, right? Like that love always involves risk, right? But I think he more is confined on this side of risk of the lover, right? Like venture to say, I love you. And there's always a risk involved with that. But I think psychoanalytically, what's more interesting is to be the receiver of the love, right? Like you're like,
wait a minute,
you're bombarding me with your love. I mean, we've all, not all of us, but many of us, I think, have been loved by someone we wish didn't love us, right? Like either it's late in the relationship, late for us, not for them, it's just someone we are not attracted to, right? I shouldn't say there are people that haven't had that experience, right? The incels have probably not had that experience, but maybe even they have. And it just wasn't the right person. You know what I mean? Like it just wasn't the person.
Well, because then they have to give up being an incel.
That's pretty good. Yeah. Anyway, so I think that
wait, Todd, hold on. Wait, yes. This is not organic, but say that's pretty good to me again. Say that's pretty good.
That's pretty good.
Thank you very little.
Does everyone know what film? Okay. Yes, everyone knows.
No, I don't think so.
Okay. All right.
Maybe some people would, yeah.
Okay. That's kind of a romantic. No, it's not a romantic comedy.
No, it's not. No. It's really not.
It's really not. It's really not.
It might be a film of the love event, perhaps, in the way that Badu, like a different person, you're a different subject for the... we're talking about Caddyshack.
Yes. Yes. Who's the love event between?
Well, because Danny has sex with
Lacey Underarts, right?
Well, yeah, but then thanks for nothing, Noonan, right? His Irish girlfriend who is dancing because she's not pregnant.
Right.
From So he's a different. That would be anyway.
All right. He has both. He has both love events.
He's
right.
Yeah. Exactly. Right. So he would be a different subject for each of those. Whatever. We could put that to one side.
Yeah.
I disrupted you. We were talking about Lacan, and we're making this.
Yeah, I just think that it isn't the disturbance much. Like, okay, there's a risk in saying I love you to someone, obviously, but the disturbance of someone loving you, even if you want them to, like, of course it's disturbing if you don't want them to, but I'm almost tempted to say it's more disturbing if you do, right? Like, because then you're like, oh my God, we're going to have to like move in together and we're going to, you know, I'm going to have to think about this person all the time and they get sick. I got to think about them. Like all these things, right? Like you have to totally reorient your life. And I think, one way I like to think of it is that the beloved takes the place for you. That little other takes the place for you of the big other, right? Like that's what it means to be in love with someone. And that is really, really disturbing.
I want to put a contemporary, a more contemporary phrase that the, that I don't know, my generation, like the Gen Z, the millennials would say, is that it's the openness to really being seen by someone is
good.
Terrifying.
That's good.
You know,
that's good.
And I think that's the, because, you know, I think, one of the, if we were rewriting like a new introductory lectures on psychoanalysis, yeah. like one of the things that we would put out front would be this. And I know you do this, when you teach, is this idea that, other people know you better than you know yourself. Yeah. And so that is, it's that premise that I think really operative when you think about like love in this theoretical way is that like, if to be open, to really be open to someone else seeing you better than you see yourself is pretty hard to give that up.
Right.
That's difficult. And it doesn't, and it's also something you have to keep giving up, I would argue, in the love relationship.
I agree. I like this
for it to be sustained.
I like this idea of, so I think it's only in English and French. Maybe someone can correct me, but I think it is of falling in love, tomber en amour in French. Mm-hmm. This idea that you fall, right? That you lose your bearings. You lose the sense, like your sense of normalcy is already shattered. And then you've said to me, like, it's like, that's what, how do you sustain a relationship? You continue falling, right? Like you don't,
yes.
you don't like, you don't turn the other person into the couch, right? Like you don't turn them into just a piece right. of furniture that you are feels comfortable to you, right? Like I think that's mm-hmm, really mm-hmm. that's really the crucial thing.
Yeah absolutely like you the this I think that what is in psychoanalysis that is not, and maybe I think you know in Mari, and I think this is in Alenka's idea as well, and I think maybe what's in the screwball comedy that's maybe not in what Bajou is saying is this, I think, this premise, this like this a priori that you have to continue to make yourself vulnerable,
yeah.
like more vulnerable.
Yeah.
Like there's not a point, like you can't reach this point where that's as vulnerable as I'm going to be.
Right. Right.
And then like, nope, that's it.
Right.
Like you can't have that sense of it because that's not being vulnerable. It's like that example that I've given a number of different times. It's like, if you are a person for whom you're really kind, like you will be burned by people. They will take advantage of you. And the solution is not, well, I'm just going to ruthlessly curate who I be kind to, because guess what? That's not being kind.
Right.
You're not kind
right.
anymore. Right. Like that's right. what an unkind person
right.
does.
Right.
There's only certain people deserve that kindness. And I think it works. It works in the love tie as well as like, nope, that's the wall. That's it. Like, I mean, certainly in relationships you work out like, you know, someone needs alone time
or
whatever, but right. you know, but like you, there has to be the continual, openness, or I think that, that extinguishes the flame.
Yeah,
if you like,
totally agree. Right. Yeah. And I also don't like this idea that like initially there's like a passionate thing and then it settles down into like a normalcy. Mm-hmm. Like I yeah. do think I'm pretty yeah. convinced, I've been with the same person for a while. I'm pretty convinced that you can still, that can be sustained the entire time. But I know, mm-hmm. I mean, we'll find out. I guess I do want to say something about, it's funny, you know, I was reading I was looking over Bad Dude last night, and he brings up this example of Andre Gortz, who writes this, he says, beautiful, like note to his wife of like, I don't know, like 60 years or something about how you're still beautiful to me, even though you're 82 and blah, blah, blah. And I couldn't help but thinking like, that's embarrassing. Like he should have said that. Like, I almost think like, obviously in private, you can say a lot of things, right? But don't put those out into the public. Like, I just think you shouldn't. And if you're going to put it out in public, you got to say it ironically, don't you? Like, you got to say it with a little something. But I want to end with Mari, who talks about endings, right? Like she's so one yes. of her critiques of Badu is that he thinks, and he's open about this in Praise of Love. He's like, you know, I ended one love event, but I learned my lesson. After that, I never ended another one. I don't know how many he's had. He doesn't volunteer that information, but he doesn't think that the end of love is an event, right? And she says, this is in, I think it's in Distillation. She says, if falling in love is an event, the end, leaving that love behind, or the end of the love, is no less an event, right? So I think that is pretty great. Like that you're like the love itself falling, totally reorients you. But then losing it can totally reorient you as well. You know, like I remember finally becoming free of my college girlfriend, and it was just such a, like the amount of feel, like no one in the French Revolution could have felt as liberated as I felt at that moment. They couldn't have. I mean, I felt like I felt so, and I'll tell you the stupidest gesture that I did to coincide with this. So one of the things that she made me do, of course, made whatever I was my own free person. I could have not
done
it.
You were complicit.
But
yeah, for sure.
So what I did, whenever we went over railroad tracks, we had to lift our feet off the ground. I don't know why. It's just some stupid little thing she did.
Okay.
So after I succeeded in getting beyond her, I drove over the rail tracks, my feet on the ground. I just it's the stupidest gesture, really, but I had so much joy. Yeah. It was like incommunicable how much fun that was for me. So, so I totally agree with Mari on this point that the end of the love event can itself be, or the end of the love affair can itself be an event, right? I think that's really important.
Yeah. No, I think that's great. I mean, like for better and for worse too.
Right. For worse, it can be for worse.
Whether you were same thing, like this, like, again, if like what you're positioning is that, like, to, you know, to fall in love is this like position of radical openness.
Right.
And then some, like, you know, on the other side, like there's maybe the euphoria of the being the breaker and the absolute nadir of being, you know, broken up with, and each of the, like, I don't think it's inconsistent with his, he's making it inconsistent.
He's
with
making
his theory,
it
but I don't think,
yeah, totally agree.
It doesn't have to be.
Totally
it's
agree.
Not by necessity have to be. Yeah.
I totally agree with that. And don't you think that, I mean, Mari's point is, unless you've ended the one, you can't start the next one. Like, I think,
yeah,
which I think would be more consistent with his theory. Like, I think it's a little too French to say, oh, I have my, I'm sorry, that was racist. But
no, that's,
I have
that's
my,
really
I have my spouse, and then I have my lover, and that we're, no, these are just separate events, and they're both, they both coincide with each other. Right. Like I think Mari just would not like that. She just doesn't accept that as a possible, you know, like she thinks you, in order to have that openness for the next love event, there has to be a terminus to the previous one. And I don't think that's correct. I think that seems like that makes a lot of sense to me. I don't know.
Thinking about how we'll never be received in Leal in the way we would have been.
I know. I just blew that. I know. That was really,
you just blew it.
That sucked.
That's very,
I'm not even going to edit it out. I'm going to leave it in.
No. there's a great line in the English comedy Blackadder, where a lot of the jokes in that show are similes, and this is the most pointless gesture since vows of fidelity was translated into French as a joke on the show. So
that's pretty great, man.
It's pretty funny.
That's
right?
Pretty, yeah, good. Yeah. Yeah.
I forget what series that's from. No, but I think it's interesting. Like again, just in being the way he sets it up, I think that, like, it's and this is what I like. I think I said this in a previous episode. I like that the way that he talks about love, or the way that he theorizes love, really is a disturbance for the rest of his idea, because he simply would not say that, like, you could have these, like, serial historical events all at the same time.
Right.
Like, it just, he wouldn't say that. I mean, like, that's why, like, it's a, a really protected category for him, you know, I'm happy that he, as you said in the last episode, he came out in support of Iran, as an event. But it's he guards that and I think that's like it's, he's like very ruthless about what is and what is not.
He's not promiscuous about the political event, but he is about the love event. Exactly.
So, and so I, so, but that's, I think that's kind of what I like about it. So, because like, so for me, we're coming sort of to the end of this, like who is my Bajou? I think for my Bajou is that the Bajou of this disturbance between how he talks about love and how he talks about the other three events and truth procedures. And it's in that disturbance that I find him provocative and I want to think through the one that's dogmatic and in asserting set theory basically the other three truth procedures I find less interesting and less compelling, but as you might expect from the show, it's the Bajou of self-contradiction is something I find really interesting to look at.
Yeah.
And I think this is kind of what we've tried to do. What we've tried to do is not like tear down the man's theory and show how it's hypocritical, but to show that like through these like tensions, through the contradiction, you can see what he's on about.
Right.
What he's really invested in, what he cares about.
Yeah, I think that's really
where
true.
Where are the lines
and where to situate him, right?
And why?
Relative to Hegel, relative to psychoanalysis. I think that's true. And I would say that one of the things I really like about him is that he's totally against this idea, like about his theory of love, is that he's totally against this idea that you can list a bunch of qualities and then say, like, put those in an ad and say, this is what I'm going to fall in love with. Because, and this is a very psychoanalytic idea, right? That what you fall in love with is not any positive characteristic, but what the person doesn't have, right? Not what they have, which ties to the Lacan idea. So I think that's a really good point that he develops. I think we got a lot of possibilities for the lesson today.
Yeah.
Don't you think?
I got one for, because I was experiencing searing foot pain, I could not locate the director in time. I wanted to recommend Pi, the Darren Aronofsky film for the last episode.
Good.
As a good film about math. I mean, it's not about math, but yeah.
Anyway, it's a great math.
I think
film.
That's a good
one. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. There we go. Yeah. But I think for this, I have, I want to know what you have, because I think I've got one for sure. I think we've recommended, but there's like a, I have a trilogy.
Okay, good. You go ahead. I'm going to hold mine back unless I find yours dissatisfying. So okay.
Okay. Right. No pressure. So I think I think the great filmmaker of contemporary filmmaker of the two, we spent a lot of this time saying that like the two doesn't happen so much in Hollywood cinema because of the turn away from what is at the core of the screwball comedy. I would say the great filmmaker of the two in the precise psychoanalytic sense is Wong Kar-wai.
Oh, yeah.
And so I would recommend the trilogy that begins with Days of Living Wild and then In the Mood for Love, which we have recommended before. But if I had to pick one of the three to be the lesson, it would be 2046.
Yeah, let's say, watch 2046. It's a great film about the failure of complementarity, I think. It really, really, I think there's an argument that it's the greatest film of the 21st century. I think there's a pretty good argument for that. Yeah. So I'm not, what was I going to counter with? Something like My Man Godfrey. That would have been weak. Okay. That's weak compared to 2046.
Caddyshack?
Well, no, Caddyshack's fine. But someday that will be the lesson. But
will be the lesson.
But not for love. I think Caddyshack can't be the lesson.
No, certainly not.
If it's if we're doing an episode on lumberyards, I think Caddyshack will definitely be the lesson. So
that would be the lesson. Yeah. That's
I noticed you own a lot of. I noticed you don't visit those lumber yards very often. That's the.
What's the next line?
No, he goes. What's wrong with a lumber yard? And Ty Webb goes, I own two of them. And Danny goes, I noticed you don't visit them very often. And Ty goes, yeah, I'm not sure where they are. All right, over and out, Ryan.
Wow. Holy mackerel.
I hardly know where we start and they finish. I felt like I was just listening to two more educated in philosophy versions of ourselves.
Yeah, it's like
felt like we had been cloned.
Nicholas and Steve du rigueur.
Yeah. Or it's like an image of what might have been. You know, you're like, well, what happens if I had taken my interest in cheesy movies and Joy Division and instead pursued academia? You know, it's a course that was of action that was at one point sort of open to me.
Yeah.
So it could have been me.
It's true.
Yes, it could have been me.
I considered it for a moment after dropping out of the California Institute of the Arts.
No kidding. Yeah.
And I mean,
and you went to Freeze Week that just after that, and you were like, no, I still love art. Wow. There's nothing that will affirm my commitment to art more than going to a stupid swap meet.
That's true. Yeah, that was exactly it. You know, I dipped my head in the fountain of youth there at the Barker Hangar. I would say that I wouldn't, you know, if we'd taken that path, one of us would end up with a broken foot, which sounds awful, but I break my foot all the time, even on this other path.
No, yeah.
Basically, I think we're just less gainfully employed than them, and they sound a lot smarter than us, so it's just kind of a lose-lose over here at the talking show.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You know what? All right, I have one ray of sunshine, which is I listened to another podcast made by really smart people called, with a really stupid name, called Byzantium and Friends.
Okay. Why is that a stupid name? It's a great name.
I mean, it's a hilarious name. and the guy who runs it is like one of the world's leading Byzantinists, which is to say largely a medievalist, but focused on non-Roman. Or to be fair, actually, it still considers itself the Roman Empire, but it's a Greek-speaking polity where like the Eastern Orthodox Church, etc., develops. As opposed to the Roman Church, yada yada yada, you know, based around Constantinople, which then becomes Istanbul, and you know, everyone on that show is like an expert at, you know, really intense stuff. There was actually, if listeners out there are interested in something really cool, there was one about like the prevalence of the punishment of blinding. And the purpose of blinding in sort of the Byzantine legal canon over the centuries in which the Byzantine Empire exists. And it was, you know, fascinating. But then they recently had a show about how to put on an exhibition. And obviously they're talking about exhibitions of historical artifacts, right? Like they're not talking about contemporary art per se. But, you know, just like...
I thought you meant how to put on a show in like during the Byzantine era.
Oh no. I mean, they had an entirely, from what I gather from the show, actually, they had an entirely different use for art.
Okay. You don't email the king.
No. And it worked. You don't send out invites saying, you know, Constantinos Gregor Lapalopoulos is pleased to announce the representation of a brand new set of, you know, icons representing Saint Petrus of Syria.
Yeah.
No, you don't send those. You don't send those kind of things out. but it was a, you know, like a situation where, just like, you know, how does an exhibition of these, like they're talking about these medieval tiles, somewhere in Massachusetts. How does something like that get put together? And, you know, and these things have to come from the British Museum, and what are loans, and how does, you know, and so lots of this stuff is exactly the same as how it would work for artwork. You know, if you were doing a retrospective of a living artist and their work is held in several collections, it's exactly the same stuff. And then designing an exhibition, obviously for artifacts, there's sort of like a more of a historical pedagogical angle than there typically would be for contemporary art, but that's not to say that that wouldn't be the case for like a retrospective or something like that, right? So I was like, you know, and like, and the way they're talking about it, it was like this was like just like an unheard of level of complexity, you know, like this was just nuts. people just do this stuff? This is insane. You know, like, you have to do this to ship tiles from the British Museum? Like, whoa, you know, like, and I was just sort of like, wow, I take all that for granted. You know, it's like, I'm like, so like, it made me feel good because I was like, well, you know what? Like, not to feel too glib about it, but I was like, you know, everything that happens, it's a little different when you're shipping antiquities, but it's not that different than shipping something that literally, like, you know, freaking Sterling Ruby or someone like that, you know, spends 1 second of thought over in their studio.
Sure.
You know? And then it sells for millions of dollars and has to be shipped as if it's like, you know, an irreplaceable set of medieval tiles, as opposed to something that comes off of an assembly line in Vernon, basically. So I feel like it's like one of those things where I was like, wow, you know, I've really gotten really like it made me feel like some gains had been made in my life. You know, these learned people were still really impressed by like the fact that like an exhibition can happen.
Yeah.
And that like what goes into making an exhibition, and like, you know, you and I are going to make an exhibition in April.
It's
like,
true.
People make we just squirt exhibitions out willy-nilly. We're just like sitting there with the foam gun, just spraying exhibitions out. Blam, blam, blam. Yeah. People are just like, you know, dancing with their arms above their heads in exhibitions, right. Exhibitions, exhibitions, exhibitions. You know, my wife just opened an exhibition the week before last.
It just takes a drill. Exhibitions. A drill and a bottle of cheap white wine. That's kind of the only...
And like, and a level. Let's be honest. Yeah, you need a level. Yeah.
If you're really fancy...
No, you need a level. Everyone needs a level, although it looks real bad. But, you know, it's like, that's it. You know, it's just like, exhibitions, we're just doing them. They're just happening. Bingo, bango, bongo. So it's like, you know, it's, I was like, wow, this is so sick. You know, like, I guess I do something, and I did learn something. You know, it's a rare moment because usually when I'm listening to that podcast, I'm similar to the feeling of listening to these guys talk about love via philosophy. I do have that feeling that I have wasted my life. that I would have been much happier as a Byzantine scholar. You know, yeah, learning ancient Greek as I had long thought I would.
Organizing shows and Byzantine artifacts.
Yeah, exactly. You know, but which what. Let me ask you this, not so much on the personal side of it, because I think you've probably got too much to think about on the personal side, but from listening to our guests' arguments, you know, they spent a long time talking about Badiou, they spent a little bit of time talking about Deleuze, a little bit of time talking about Lacan, a little bit of time talking about Zizek, a little bit of time talking about Hegel and Plato, etc. earlier on. Did you have a sense of like which argument they found most convincing? In terms of their thoughts about love,
I think Hegel,
yeah,
for sure. And but then the whole long section on Badiou, they were kind of apologists for him. You know, they're like, "Hey, we know our students hate this guy, but we're just trying to bring him to light in a way that helps him out a little bit better." You know, helps him to be seen. I think they even said, or. So, but I think, yeah, Hegel being the underpinning, Kant being kind of the jokester.
The punchline, yeah.
And
well, no, to be fair, no one has a more anemic or poorly thought out version of what human love is like.
Yeah.
Despite all of his other, like, the vast contributions to epistemology, there is absolutely no one with a worse take or, like, a less fleshed out understanding of love. Than Kant.
Very true. Very true. Yeah, so I'm gonna say Hegel. They like that short piece he wrote on love and see him as the, I think they said, the philosopher of Christianity, love being a pretty strong category in Christian religion. I get probably all religions, but definitely the Christian one.
Yeah, it's different. I think it's different for different people, you know.
Sure.
Like there's like infinite compassion in Buddhism, but
okay.
You don't really love anything. It's not love. It's compassion.
Yeah.
Which might actually, you know, whatever. Arguably, that's the same thing as like agape and sort of the Christian framing of it. But they didn't even really cross the sort of Tiber path. You know, they're not drifting as far as Asia here on in today's conversation. This is purely Western philosophy.
No,
we're staying in the Occident here.
I feel like the overwhelming insight of their presentation was that for people trained in continental philosophy, there's not a lot of dealing with love. It's not, you know, there are big gaps. There aren't too many perspectives to draw from.
You're stuck with Hegel and Badiou.
Yeah, pretty much. Everyone else is, you know, are dealing with other subjects.
And then the side angle of like sort of the weird creepy masturbator of Deleuze or whatever.
Yeah.
Right. The sort of like, with like a detour through Freud too, I guess that's the other aspect of it where it's like love is very important to that conversation in Freud. Cause it's like, you know, all them drives.
Yeah.
It's the intersection of all them drives. But yeah, no, I found I think I definitely felt like our guests landed on the side of Hegel, and the sort of contradictory nature of what it is to love.
Yeah.
It definitely made me think about it, you know? I was sort of like, wow. that is pretty true. and also like within the Hegelian definition, it also sort of explains why it's so painful when it goes wrong. You know? When you're putting someone above all else in your mind, but then this is a choice you've made, but then there's the miracle, I guess, is that like that would be a mutual scenario, that two people would do that to each other, kind of thing. The way that when that doesn't work out, you know, you're sort of stuck thinking, you know, like why don't they feel the same way about me or whatever, and then the fact is that like it's a choice you made to feel that way about them, you know, like that. And that's the part that like really sucks. When I'm just, you know, while listening to the talk today, I really reflected on sort of like not just the relationship that I'm still having after, you know, almost 8 years, but the relationships I have had, because before this one that's worked out pretty well so far, there were a bunch that worked out fine for a while and then did not, or never worked out fine. Were just sort of like efforts of stubborn will, or were just like dens of confusion. And I think, you know, definitely there is an aspect to the sort of bit with Badiou where you're like a different person for everyone, which I think that's definitely true as well. I was different in every, I'm different in every interaction. The Steve that does the talking show is different than the Steve that, you know, the Steve at home. Wow. The wind is really nuts, huh?
It really is. Yeah.
This is insane. The K-Chunk studio is very high up in the air. And so it feels, well, it's alarming. Maybe it's not making it through the microphones to Radio Land, but this is like physically quite alarming.
In preparing for our wedding, we're like kind of making the rounds with Ella's parents' friends who want to take us out to dinner, which has been quite nice.
Sounds wonderful.
Yeah, we've
congratulations.
Only done one so far.
Mazel tov.
And the couple that took us out, the fellow has a long reputation of being an agent provocateur in conversation. So he asked early on, you know, how we met, all that kind of stuff. But then asked, is there anyone else you've been with that you thought could have been the one? Which obviously is going to create some tension.
Wow, what a jerk.
Yeah. So, you know, and I don't drink very much these days, but I had a few glasses
really
of wine.
Stirring the pot.
Yeah.
Way to go, dude.
That's his favorite thing to do.
Yeah.
So Ella said, well, I answered first, foolishly, and I said yes.
No. Nicholas, shut up. No.
But I thought about this. You know, I have a better way of framing it now that we've heard Todd and Ryan. It was an ex of mine, you know, named Emily, who we split in a rather violent way that was kind of her doing, I'd say. I think she'd admit that if she heard this, hopefully. And I think that in a way, you know, I had loved her and I had seen myself through her. And when you break up in that way, you don't get that part back. You know, there's no real way. It's like you kind of like it's severed so quickly, you just lost it. And because everyone, when I told the story of how it went down, everyone's like, oh, you just haven't had that lunch, you know, where you see the person 10 years later and have lunch and you're like, that was the person? Oh my gosh, I'm so glad I'm not in that anymore. And which undoubtedly will happen at some point in our lives. We'll run into each other or something. And that made me really optimistic about marriage as in a way, a kind of public promise that you're not going to sever it in that way. You know, you're not going to just lop it off the way that you can if you're not committed in this way.
Yeah, you know, I think there's lots of great things about marriage now that I've been in it for a little while too. It's like it does change how you address certain how you face certain problems. Even if you have like a very good sort of problem solving, you know, if you're able to have great, clear discussions and stuff like that within the context of like a relationship, I feel like sort of something about sort of the institutional tying together means that like you are actually forced to consider things quite differently. And over time you realize that like it's more than the sum of both parts kind of thing. Like it's not about what you can get out of it or what, you know, it's sort of just like, oh, we're doing this thing and we do this thing together kind of thing, which I think is, well, that's something I take great pride in actually, in my own relationship. But, yeah, I was just thinking about, you know, just to answer the same question that, this deliberate provocation that was like lobbed at your way at a nice dinner. Where was this dinner held, by the way? Can I just like, how nice a dinner is this?
It was at their house.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I assume it's also pretty nice.
It's not too
but
shabby.
You know, like I think when someone asked that question, like anyone who knows me sort of medium well over the last 10 years would be like, oh yeah, Steve tried to marry that other person.
Yeah, that one's not a mystery.
Like the facts are just clear. You know what I mean? Like I almost went all the way. Yeah, it's like it almost totally happened. Like there's no weaseling out of it. Like I, in a way, like in my case, it's like, it's almost like a get out of jail free card for having actually sort of almost done it once.
Yeah.
You know, like, yeah, it's like asking a divorced person. So yeah, is there anyone like, else well, you ever thought could be like the one? You're like, well, there was my first wife. Yeah.
No, I think like, something that Ella and I have been struggling with, is just like, it already feels different. But we've been together for almost 9 years. And so that's longer than a lot of marriages last. So in a way, part of it's like, well, this is just perfunctory, but it's not, you know, and then also trying to like suss out, like, cause a lot of people like in my life who've got married, they dated for a couple years and then they got married and started having kids or something. And so it was like still in that kind of testing period of the relationship. And it's like, we've been together long enough now that it's like, well, what does this mean beyond just, some institutional, bond? And that's, so we've been, I feel like a lot of times we've been just driving to people, they're like, they're like, that's not what's usually said. And I'm like, well, I mean, we're doing it late, I guess.
Yeah, no, it's true. It's like, Meredith and I have been together for almost 10 years now.
Yeah.
You know, like not married for that long, but,
sure.
Yeah. No, that's wild. Anyway, well, congratulations to you both. By the time we record the next episode of The Talking Show, the holy deed shall be accomplished.
Perhaps. There's a Wednesday before.
Oh, there is. It's not like this Friday?
No, it's next Friday. I hope. That's
that's right. Jeez Louise, notes in March. Thank you. Woo! I was like, what do I wear? Ay, ay, ay.
Yeah, I'm going to the dry cleaner after this, Steve. Mine's open late.
This is an audio medium, so people can't tell that I've become like way too large to fit into any of my nice clothes from the past. And and a lot of people I know, not just you, Nicholas, are getting married this year, and I'm just worried. You know, I'm worried that like, I'm worried that this ship won't turn around. First of all, that like if I were to purchase something now, that like who's to say in a month or two from now when the next matrimonial event occurs, I won't also be just like, I won't have exploded some more.
I thought you were at Maximum Steve. This was proclaimed recently.
Well, I'm always Maximum Steve. This is the thing. This is the thing about Maximums is you can always be Maximum Steve. I remain at maximum speed. It's like any
Olympic record, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. This is the largest I've ever been. And so Maximum Steve continues, and where and how I get to where Maximum Steve ends and where that where the record is set is still an open question. And so I'm just trying hard to not compete for the record too hard now, because I'm realizing that, like, I kind of don't want to buy. I don't want to enter. It's stressful to buy clothes. It's stressful to figure out what looks good. I don't want to re-enter this discussion with myself at the moment. I'd rather focus on, you know, making artwork after the revivifying experience of going to Freeze. And I would instead like to, you know, focus on, you know, day job and other things. So I'm very sort of grumpy about all this, but got to figure out what to wear. And I just don't feel like I can trust myself, but I also don't feel like, fortunately, I'm glad that I in my mind, I got the date wrong, because like, God only knows what I would have actually ended up wearing. Just like a potato sack or something. Like I just show up in my sweats wearing these like these karate pants that I wear around the house all the time. That's like the only thing that can accommodate my exploding body.
Come however you want, anywho, Steve. It doesn't matter to
well,
me.
Well, just going to let it all hang out, Nick.
On that note, good morning, Chinatown.
Good night.